You're listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast, where we shine light on the dark side of Christianity and how it affects people and communities. I'm Robin Mitchell Stroud, and I'm here with my co-host, Deborah Levy Martinelli. We'll be covering a variety of topics, from individual survivor stories, including our own, to the influence of religion on our national politics. To learn more about the podcast, visit our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or connect with us on TikTok and Instagram at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TICC_podcast_. Now, on to the show. Welcome to the podcast. We are so excited to have a great guest with us today. I'm talking about Dr. Charles Kimball, an ordained Baptist minister. Dr. Kimball holds a Master of Divinity from the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and a Doctor of Theology in Comparative Religion from Harvard with specialization in Islamic studies. Over the past 40 years, Dr. Kimball has made more than 40 visits to the Middle East, including living in Egypt as a young scholar, and during the past 30 years has worked closely with Congress, the White House, and the State Department on matters related to Judaic, Christian, Islam relations. Between 2008 and 2020, Dr. Kimball served as chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Before joining OU, he was a professor of comparative religion for 12 years at Wake Forest University. He is a frequent invited lecturer and speaker on issues related to the Middle East, Islam, Jewish-Christian-Muslim relations, and the intersection of religion and politics. Dr. Kimball is the author of 6 books, including When Religion Becomes Evil, 5 Warning Signs, which was hailed as one of the most acclaimed post-9/11 books on terrorism and religion. Also, When Religion Becomes Lethal, the explosive mix of politics and religion in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And finally, his latest book, Truth Over Fear, Combating the Lies About Islam. Welcome, Dr. Kimball. It's an honor to have you here with us today.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Dr. Kimball, we'd like to start with learning a little bit more about you. We know your credentials for sure, but we're wondering how you became interested in the religious and political interplay among Jewish, Christian, and Muslim countries and peoples.
Well, briefly, I would say it really began in childhood. My father, my father's father, my paternal grandfather was Jewish. It's a long and colorful story. If you know the story, if your listeners, watchers know the story of Fiddler on the Roof, ours was one of those families in real life. My great grandfather, who passed away long before I was born, was an Orthodox Jewish cantor. They lived in the Poland-Russia area and were forced out in the latter part of the 19th century in a Christian pogrom against the Jews. They came, like many immigrants did, at the turn of the 20th century. And settled and went through Ellis Island, settled in Boston eventually. And so my grandfather was one of 9 children in a Jewish family. As I said, it's a very colorful story. He and one of his brothers ended up becoming famous song dance comedians in vaudeville, during which time he met my grandmother, who was a Presbyterian chorus girl in the vaudeville show. And so, as I like to say, we have some pretty racy pictures of grandma about 100 years ago, kicking up her heels in the chorus line. She was from the Missouri-Oklahoma area, and so when they left show business, they settled back in Oklahoma. Mixed marriages were very difficult, of course, 100 years ago, much more common now. And so I grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, with a Jewish grandfather who was the most wonderful person I knew. And I was taught by my parents and through my experience that we're Christians, but it's also good to be Jewish. Not just okay to be Jewish, good to be Jewish. About the time I got to the 3rd grade, I discovered that was not a view widely shared in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I didn't know what anti-Semitism was, but in retrospect, that's what I began hearing on the playground and street corners from people who I knew even as a 3rd grader or 4th grader had no idea. They never even met anybody Jewish, but they were saying things that today we would see as being racist and bigoted and just ignorant. And so that really bothered me as a child. So I tell that story to sort of say the seed was planted pretty early on that I began to kind of ponder and wrestle with the question, well, what does it mean to be a person of faith, a Christian in my case, but with an awareness that I could have been born into another part of my own family and I'd be Jewish. Where is God and all that? How do you make sense of that? Did I just get lucky I got born into the right religion, or is maybe something else going on here that we haven't thought enough about? And so that really sparked my interest, not only as I pursued my own study and sort of spiritual growth within the Christian tradition, but an interest in the study of world religions. I wasn't satisfied with what I heard other people saying and thought, well, I need to know for myself, not depend on other experts, quote unquote, to tell me what to think about the Hindus and the Buddhists and the Jews and the Muslims and others, Native Americans in Oklahoma, of course. And so I really began studying alongside of Christian studies, began studying world religions. I was fortunate to get into the doctoral program, as you noted, at Harvard, which was a fantastic program at the time, and maybe still the best in the world. And so in that context, one of our requirements to study world religions, you specialize in two traditions, your own and then another tradition, presumably, but then study more broadly world religions. One of the requirements was that you live somewhere in the world where the religious tradition that you were focusing on, in my case, Islam, was the dominant religion. So it was moving beyond an academic approach to an experiential and academic one, where you're in a cultural context. If you were studying the Hindu tradition primarily, you'd live in India. If you were studying Buddhism, you might go to Sri Lanka, you might go to Thailand, you might go any number of places where Buddhism was predominant, etc. If you're studying Japanese tradition, you'd go to Japan for a year at least. So it was in that context in 1977, 78, my spouse and I lived in Cairo. That happened to be the year, some people will recall, in October of 77, when we were there, was when Anwar Sadat one day stunned the world and announced he was going to Jerusalem to make peace with Israel. That was a stunning development that opened up the Camp David process and so forth. So that really drew me in even more to contemporary dynamics with Jewish, Christian, Muslim relations, with Jewish family background, Christian background, but a student of Islam. I was really interested in the interplay in the Abrahamic traditions. And it was an increasingly important time politically because you had, of course, the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Lebanon was starting to really disintegrate into a multi-sided civil war. There were rumblings in Iran. Egypt had considerable unrest even during the Sadat time. And so there were just a lot of things going on that drew me in more to the political dynamics. I won't elaborate on it here, but through a series of events in 1979, when the American embassy in Iran was taken over by student militants who were initially protesting the fact that the Shah had been admitted to the United States, presumably for medical treatment. It turned out it was for medical treatment, but they were afraid, as many others were, that the U.S. was preparing another coup, as had been the case in 1953, to bring the Shah back into power. And so that was the ostensible reason for taking over the embassy. Through a series of events, I was one of seven people invited to Iran, six clergy and one former Peace Corps worker. I was 29 years old. I was the kid in the group. Others were very prominent religious leaders. But I had lived in the Middle East and had spent a lot of time studying and engaging Christian-Muslim relations. And so we were invited to Iran in the second month around Christmas time of 1979 to basically go and to help facilitate communications. The governments were not talking directly to each other. It had grown into a very intense international conflict, obviously. And we were the only people. We were invited to meet with Ayatollah Khomeini in his home on Christmas Day. In 1979, we were the only seven Americans to ever meet with him during the hostage crisis. I think there might have been an Iranian-American journalist who also got some kind of interview with him, but we met with him. And that opened the door to meet with the student militants in the embassy, with all the religious and political leaders in Iran. And again, I write about this in some of my books. What that opened up, I mean, nobody knew this would go on for 444 days, of course, at that time. But the student militants in the embassy, where we spent about 3 hours that first trip, they developed a level of trust with me and one other person in our group, especially. And so we were invited to come back anytime, not knowing how long this would last or what was going to happen. And so on two other occasions, I was back in Iran taking mail from hostage families to the hostages via the students and meeting with government and religious leaders to help facilitate communication. We weren't negotiating on behalf of the United States. We weren't government officials. So I spent about 2 months in Iran during the hostage crisis. And then also, of course, when I came back, I was doing a tremendous amount of media because of just the buzz of, oh, you actually met the Ayatollah, oh, you were inside the embassy with the students, that kind of thing. And so I go into a little bit more detail there to sort of lay the background as to how I got more deeply involved in contemporary issues at the intersection of religion and politics and Christian-Muslim relations in particular. And why my own commitment to understanding the nonviolent conflict resolution all figured into that. That while I and others obviously were very much opposed to the holding of the hostages, this was an illegal and immoral act, something that I felt and would say openly to the students and others was going to hurt Iran and their revolution. I also understood a good deal as to what the fears were and what motivations were for the revolutionary movement to oust this dictatorial leader, the Shah. And so I was trying my best to help people understand in the United States through lectures, through op-ed pieces, various things, that Iran has suffered a great deal and there were nonviolent ways to resolve this very difficult conflict. And that's what we should be trying to do rather than bombing Tehran or mining their harbors or doing some other kind of military action. And of course, it dragged on for a long time, but fortunately, the people were ultimately released and no one was killed in that particular process. There were people who were killed when the raid took place, when the attempted rescue took place in April of 1980. But it was ultimately resolved nonviolently. And still a very sticky point, obviously, between the U.S. and Iran and a long history there. Then I got very much involved in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in the 80s, directed the Middle East office for the National Council of Churches. Again, I was probably 20 years younger than any of my contemporaries. But as the dean of Harvard Divinity School once put it in an interview, he said that I'd had about 20 years experience crammed into two. And I think there was an element of truth to that, that it was a pretty intense situation. And I did a tremendous amount of media and so forth in the process. So that's kind of the bigger background. In 1990, I returned to full-time teaching at Furman University in South Carolina and then to Wake Forest. And then in 2008, as you noted, I was lured back to my home state of Oklahoma to help build a new religious studies program, which I did for the last 12 years.
Well, Dr. Kimball, I'm particularly intrigued by your time in that area in 1979. I wish I had known you back then because I was working at ABC Radio News as a desk assistant when the hostage crisis first happened. So knowing someone who not only was an observer there, but a participant is just fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't want to take up all the podcast time with stories about that, but I'll tell you one sort of fun one. The ABC and particularly Good Morning America had gotten a hold of us. We were John Walsh, who was a longtime chaplain, just recently retired from the Redlands University in California, and I were the two who went back two more times. He was at the time chaplain at Princeton University back in the late 70s. And we were, Good Morning America got a hold of us, and they were eager because we were there the last month of the hostage crisis. And they wanted to interview us because we were the only Americans who had access. We were meeting with Prime Minister Rafsanjani, with Sadegh Gopsadeh, the foreign minister, with the student militants. We had access to everyone, which very few people did. And it was really because we'd met with the Khomeini that gave us the kind of imprimatur that we were safe, we were trustworthy, or he never would have met with us, was the kind of rationale that people had there. In any case, there had been a plan in place when the hostages were going to be released, that they would be released. And the two of us who were clergy would meet with them, have a short prayer service, grateful that this had ended nonviolently, help escort them onto the plane to go to Algeria and then to Wiesbaden, West Germany, where they were going to be met and taken care of physically and so on. But there were some of the student militants who didn't want to do that. Who were resisting. And so they ended up not doing that, but having a kind of bad gauntlet where they made them go and they were yelling at them. And it was just a dumb, very dumb thing for them to do. But when we realized they weren't necessarily going to do this, we said, well, we're leaving. We're going to go. We left the day before. And so we flew out and flew to Wiesbaden. And so John and I were on the first half hour with Peter Jennings, who was the correspondent in the studio in Germany at the time, as they were preparing for the release of the hostages. And it was also the morning that Ronald Reagan was inaugurated, January 20th, 1981. And so apparently we were, it was one of the most watched half hours in American television history. Everybody got up. It was inauguration day, but also the day the hostages were going to be released. Fortunately, we faded into memory. Our families remember we were on that morning, but probably no one else. It was really, really fascinating to be there with Peter Jennings, who was a remarkable journalist and broadcaster. He had a lot of time in the Middle East and knew the Middle East very well. But the funny part of the story was, and I could go on and on, I'll make this brief. A couple of years later, they ended up paying for our tickets back because we had to stop and it broke up everything. And so they said, well, we'll fly you back, you know, to the U.S. from Germany. You know, just come on, don't go to NBC or CBS, you know, come on us first, that kind of thing. So we did. About 2 years later, David Hartman was the host of Good Morning America at the time. About 2 years later, I was on a shuttle flight from New York to D.C., and I'm on the plane, and the very last second, this large man comes rumbling down the aisle. It's David Hartman. And the only seat left is the one, the middle seat right next to me for the shuttle. And he sits down, and of course, he's very, very well known. And I said, he sat down, and once we were settled, I said, I know you probably hear this all the time. You meet people or someone says, oh, I met you back when. I said, but I did. I was actually on Good Morning America a couple of years ago on a pretty memorable day. And he looked at me and he literally said, Reverend Kimball. He said, I remember. He said, boy, you have no idea what went on there. He said, to get you back, we had to borrow the credit card of one of our staff people, a secretary or somebody in his office, because it was the weekend, and they had to charge our plane tickets to her credit card and get her. So he started telling me this whole story about what a crazy deal it was. It was just a slapdash last minute thing, but he remembered the whole thing obviously very well. So there are a whole lot of sort of fun stories along with the drama of the whole event. But you mentioned ABC, and so I had several experiences with ABC at the time.
I have a question rumbling around in my head, but I'm not entirely sure how to ask it. So I've heard you say, or I've read that you've said that the stakes are too high to avoid or underestimate the volatile mix of religion and politics, which is why you've been describing in those with that situation. And also in When Religion Becomes Lethal, you talk about how even the small numbers of religious zealots or extremists can wreak havoc on a regional or even global scale. So I kind of want you to speak a little bit more about that. But I also was rumbling around, this is it's a convoluted question, but also it occurs to me that we are so insulated from all of that in the U.S. So I'm just wondering, I know that part of your life's mission has been to get people to better understand those dynamics. How do we do that when it's not in our own backyard in the way that it is, like in the area that you've just described?
Well, I think the 9/11 brought it to our backyard for a lot of people. And I mean, if you look statistically, which may or may not be helpful to people, the danger of being harmed in an extremist act by a Muslim extremist in the United States is pretty minimal. There's a lot more dangers out there, as the FBI keeps pointing out. White supremacist groups and others pose a far greater threat in this country. But there are extremists. There are people who claim inspiration from Islam, and we can't ignore that reality in different places for a variety of reasons in different settings. It's not monolithic. It's not just one thing. But there are people who have come to believe, and we see them in groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, but also there's Boko Haram, there's some other groups in different places, that somehow violence is justified because of the injustices they've endured or the bad governments they've had and so forth and so on. They have, there are reasons why people become extremists. Not to say it's correct, but they don't just wake up one day and say, hey, I think I'll go blow up a building for the heck of it. There are reasons why people feel motivated to move. And extremism, violence and terrorism is really a weapon of the weak. It's a way of drawing attention to a cause that you can't easily draw attention to otherwise. And in that sense, it works. You know, when you do something horrible and dramatic, people are saying, what is going on? You know, why did they do that? And so forth. So it's an attention getting sort of device. You can't fight, the United States with nuclear weapons, but you look for the Achilles heel. You know, where can you hit that it hurts and gets attention? So I'm not justifying any of that. I'm just explaining the dynamic. And so the fear and the combination, the dynamic that has been developing for a long time, and the Iranian Revolution was a major sort of point here, because here was a government that, in the words of Henry Kissinger, Secretary of State, famously said, the Shah is our unconditional ally. And those are chilling words. No matter what you ever do, you're our ally. Well, he was one of the worst violators of human rights in the world. And this was during the Carter administration when, Carter's, one of his major themes was human rights. He was a little bit slow to talk about Iran and the Philippines, but he was very, strong on human rights in various other places. But the U.S. and Iran had an incredibly tight strategic relationship. It was sitting at the soft underbelly of the Soviet Union. The Shah was by far the biggest purchaser of weapons in the United States. Oil prices had soared in the 70s. The Shah was making billions and spending billions in the United States. We had a massive involvement in Iran and presence there that was strategically very important during the Cold War, of course. And so there were all those dynamics that are at work. And here was somebody who had a powerful military, an incredibly strong secret police, a very repressive regime, who was toppled in a nonviolent revolution by people marching in the streets, yelling, God is great, or getting up on, they'd send a message out, everybody go up on your rooftop at midnight tonight, and for 5 minutes, just keep yelling, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, and let that ring out over the city. Well, how do you stop that? And so this really sent shockwaves throughout the Middle East and beyond, that even the most brutal dictators could be toppled. You can't rule without some measure of consent of the public. And when people are willing to die, as many did in Iran, shot down innocently in the streets, you really don't have any power over them if your threat is to kill them. And so this was a message. And if you look at the 80s, you see change, occurs in South Africa and the Philippines and some parts of Central America, not because of Khomeini, but because of the message that dictators can be toppled, systems can change. Of course, part of the response to that is the people like Saddam Hussein, who saw that too, and he just tightened down the repression all the more. And just, brutalized people and made it a capital offense to say something bad about the president and so forth. So this fervor that was growing in certain quarters, particularly in the predominantly Islamic lands, combined with a long history, and that's part of what I try to deal with in my books, this long history of anti-Islamic sentiment that runs very deep in the West. Islam is the only religious tradition that has really ever threatened Christendom. Once Christianity sort of grew beyond its humble beginnings out of Judaism and became the state religion of Rome in the fourth century, there was never any danger that Scandinavian mythology was going to make a big comeback, or the Native American traditions were going to overcome Christianity or African traditional religions or anything else. But here comes a religious system in the seventh century that is not only incredibly successful militarily, economically, in terms of a great civilizational system, but also many parts of the Christian world embrace, because part of the message of Islam is it's not a new religion, it's the same religion. It's the same religion that produced through prophets what we call Judaism and Christianity, but now we have a final revelation through the prophet Muhammad. And it's a religion that's talking about God, the God of Abraham and Moses and Jesus. It's talking about angels and devils and the day of judgment and the Virgin Mary. Sounds a lot like our religion, except they're winning. And so you go through crusades, and there's just a long history of antipathy that develops, particularly towards Islam, as a threat. And in many ways, it was a threat at times, militarily, obviously. And so Islam is in a distinct position. Even when I was doing my doctorate, I'm meandering a little bit here, but I'll bring it back to the, to your point. When I was starting my doctoral program, I can't tell you how many people in 1975 said, you know, why are you studying Islam? You'll never get a job. You know, all the interest coming out of the 60s was in the Eastern religions. Remember, the Beatles found the Maharishi, and they were, and so there was all this interest in turning east to the exotic religions of the East, Hinduism and Buddhism and Native American traditions, and all of that kind of thing was big in the 60s and into the 70s. But I was just, I guess, brash enough to say, look, I'm getting my doctorate from Harvard. I got to believe I can get a job somewhere teaching world religions. And of course, now, you know, it turned out to be a pretty good move in terms of what ends up happening in the flow of events. So there's that sort of deep bias. And then you have, you know, extremism and even Palestinian events of Palestinian terrorism that have occurred. This is not Muslim. You know, a significant portion of Palestinians are Christians. Some of the leaders in the PLO were Christians. But it always was labeled, you know, as though this is somehow Islam, and it's Islam versus Judaism in Israel, which it was a political, it's political more than religious, although the two do get intertwined in different ways, sadly. So there's all of that, and this deep bias came to the fore with the Iranian Revolution especially, and then with the rise of various groups, like we saw in Lebanon, Hezbollah and others. In Lebanon, that this was a real threat. And again, this is putting in a much bigger context. But once the Soviet Union fell, you can go back and I'm pretty confident this would hold up and look and see the United States was looking pretty hard to find a big enemy out there. And at first, maybe it's going to be Japan. And then President H.W. Bush went to Japan and actually threw up on the prime minister at a dinner. And they said somehow it didn't seem to be that scary anymore. But there was going to be the two Germanys. When the two Germanys got back together, this was going to be a world power. And, well, that didn't turn out to be Islam. Ah, there is the global threat that we're up against. And it's rooted in some reality, given the breadth of, you know, over 55 countries have Muslim majorities, many of them in turmoil, many of them ruled by unrepresentative leaders, et cetera. So all of that sort of... there, to come back to your original question, or one portion of your original question, you know, our mothers, most of us had mothers who taught us not to talk about religion and politics in polite company, that this was not the thing to do. And my point is that silence is making a decision, that the stakes are far too high for us not to be talking about the dynamics of religion and politics. We've just come through 4 years in this country where it's been very difficult to talk, even within our own families. But it should be really obvious. It is to me. It should be very obvious to other people acting as though, well, you have your opinion, I have mine, when basic facts are being just completely distorted. You know, how can you be silent in the face of that? When democracy is being undermined and threatened in all sorts of ways, is it responsible to just say, oh, well, that you have your right to your opinion? No, the election wasn't rigged. The election was won by Joe Biden. And we need to be able to say that to people. In my view, we need to be able to say, get your damn vaccine. You know, come on, quit being an idiot. You know, the rest of us are, you know, out here too. And my brother died from COVID. A first cousin died from COVID. A former pastor died from COVID. I know 7 people personally who died in the last year. And I still run into people who are saying, oh, so it's real? Yeah, it's real. This anti-scientific, and to me, it's anti-intellectual, it's anti-rational. And this comes right back to what we're talking about with Islam. So what I'm doing in Truth Over Fear is saying we need to take a step back and try to understand where the fear, where the bias comes in, acknowledging that there are people doing extremist things in the name of Islam. That's not unique to Islam, as I talk about it when religion becomes evil. In fact, I argue Christians are the last people who should be pointing their finger at anybody in terms of how they've collectively used violence to enforce their will and their theological views down through the centuries. And so we have to be willing to take an honest look at ourselves too, and the dangers inherent in resorting to violence in the name of religion. So all of that suggests to me that we have to be much more open and willing to talk about difficult subjects, and religion and politics are two of the big ones.
How do we talk to each other about these issues? I'm Jewish, and I'm sure my conversations are probably very different from those that, for example, Robin may have. So what do we do to start those conversations?
I do think that where we began, and obviously I'm in a little different position than a lot of people with my history and background and experience and so forth. Not everybody is a, quote, expert on the Middle East, but or major world religions. But we all have constituents. We all have circles of influence. We have family members. We have friends. And I think that's where you have to sort of start, is, you know, talking and being able to develop at a level of trust that you have with people about issues that you care about. And especially, I would say, as American citizens, we have a particular responsibility, because what our government does in the world has a huge impact on people all over the world. If you happen to live in Norway and your government makes a pronouncement or something, well, okay. But when the United States sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. And so that, I think, puts a special responsibility on us to be participants in our own democratic process and discussion and dialogue. And that begins with, you know, in circles that you're comfortable in, but also means expressing yourself to your representatives in Congress, writing letters to the editor. And one of the things I've noticed just among my own Jewish family members is that particularly after the invasion of Lebanon, there began to be more willingness on the part of many Jewish Americans to talk about, well, Israel isn't perfect. I mean, whereas before, there had been a little bit of a code of silence that somehow, if you somehow criticize Israel, then you're weakening and you're putting them in more danger and so forth. But I think an awful lot of Jewish Americans have, you know, come to the conclusion that they care enough about the survival and safety of Israel not to be uncritical. But democracy demands a critical approach. In fact, I was always amazed by that difference. I spent many hours in the Knesset in Jerusalem. I mean, it's like a food fight in there. They take democracy very seriously in Israel. They argue and debate and practically throw chairs at each other trying to make their points. And it's healthy. You watch it and you go, wow, you know, not everybody in Israel thinks the same way. If you just happen to read the Jerusalem Post or Haaretz or something, you get that point pretty quickly that there's a tremendous, you take democracy seriously. And yet over here, it was more like, oh, well, we can't. I never had too much difficulty dealing with those issues. A lot of people I found over the years were caught sort of silenced because someone would say, well, you're anti-Semitic. And, you know, I simply, if anybody ever tried to throw that at me, I just let it roll right off and say, no, I'm not. I'm like anybody else. I probably have prejudices that I don't fully understand or, you know, that are woven into the fabric of my cultural context, but I'm not anti-Jewish. I am very pro-human, and I'm going to speak up for Palestinians, Muslims, and Christians, as well as Israeli Jews. I think Israel has a right to exist with safety and security. And I say that to, I said that to Yasser Arafat directly when I had meetings with him. No big shocker there, but I'm not simply pro-Palestinian and whatever that means. I think there's a way to be affirming of more than one truth. And that's part of the difficulty, I think, of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that there's more than one truth that's present. And so the only way ultimately is some kind of accommodation or some kind of recognition that you can't have everything you think you deserve because there's a truth that exists for other people that is just as valid and just as real, maybe coming from a little different direction. But the goal should be to find a way to have a hopeful and healthy future for everyone. And I remain committed to that, even though at the moment that's kind of a back burner issue given all that's going on elsewhere. But I think there are ways to talk about these things if you're just willing to do it and open up with people and be willing to listen and maybe have to do some homework when people raise questions. I don't know the answer to that, but I'm going to look into it and try to learn a little bit more. That's really a lot of, as you know from my books, I'm one of those academicians who is very concerned to actually communicate to normal human beings. I've never been particularly, I appreciate scholars who write very technical, you know, sort of articles and publications that 12 people read and react to. I've been much more interested in how to translate what I have the luxury of spending time studying, reflecting on, connecting to personal experience, et cetera, to people who don't have the luxury of that kind of time for investment, but who care about the issues. And so I think it's important that at least some of us try to write in a way that is actually digestible for people. And hopefully that gives people tools like the little book, Truth Over Fear, which got off to a terrific start when it was published in late 2019. And then the pandemic just kind of shut everything down because it's really designed for clergy and study groups and individuals who are concerned. Well, study groups kind of stopped, except, I've done a dozen Zoom meetings with adult study groups and churches or something, but I was doing lecturing all over the place when it first came out. And everybody was understandably so consumed with, in church settings, especially just how to keep the church functioning and how to have services online and so forth. So that kind of slowed that down, but it's really designed as a kind of resource for people who kind of know that there's something, this is not good, what's happening in Christian-Muslim relations, and we need to do better, but I don't know enough. So here's a way to sort of begin to educate yourself and have discussions, even their discussion questions at each chapter to facilitate groups. To sort of get into these questions in non-threatening ways.
Dr. Kimball, I want to backtrack a little bit to the fear element, because I'm curious if you had, well, it's both the fear element and talking to people sort of locally. And it goes back to, I was reading about in When Religion Becomes Lethal that you were clarifying what actually constitutes Sharia law. And it made me, I don't know that we have time for you to explain Sharia law for our listeners, but what it reminded me of was voters in Oklahoma approving a ballot measure in November 2010 to amend the state constitution to ban Sharia from the state courts. And then later it was updated to include all foreign or religious laws. Well, that's so fear-based and also overturned. But what was your conversation with people at that time? How did you encounter that with people?
That all developed very quickly, kind of a slapdash that got put in pretty late. And so it was really kind of a shocker to most of us that, you know, it was there. And then a 70% plurality voted to ban Sharia and other forms of international law. I was like, what are you talking about? You mean you can't do business with Sweden now? What's that about? You know, it just showed how half-baked the whole thing was. And of course, it was thrown out by federal courts fairly quickly as being, you know, unsupportable. I'm not in Oklahoma now, but I did a kind of informal, non-scientific survey myself over the next 7-8 years, where almost every time I talked to different clergy, I would at some point sort of slip in the trick question, you know, about question 3 or 4, saying, well, hey, what about this Sharia law thing? You know, that we had this thing in Oklahoma. What do you think about that? And, you know, like 90%+ of the people I talked to, oh, well, I'm against it. And I said, well, I understand that. A lot of people were against it. But what specifically are you concerned about? Well, you know, Sharia. I don't want Sharia. So, okay, but what is it about Sharia? Sharia! Mm-hmm. In other words, they couldn't even tell you what it was, but they knew it was bad and we're going to stop it at the Red River. It's not coming into Oklahoma. And so, you know, I would try to say, I happen to actually know quite a bit about this. Sharia is not one fixed thing. It's like other legal systems that, yes, you see something from Afghanistan where they've stoned a woman, they say, you know, committed adultery. Horrible. There are only 3 Muslim countries in the world that practice capital punishment. How is that? If originally there were certain, you know, punishments, Saudi Arabia has capital punishment. Pakistan, I think, does. And I think Iran does. Let's take a look and see what is Sharia. It does alter. And let me just give you an example. The penalty initially for theft is cutting off your hand. Well, that's, you know, kind of an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, brutal. It would get your attention and maybe stop other people from stealing. But very early on, Muslims realized, well, wait a second, there's a difference between my breaking into your house and stealing your gold and jewelry and a father of six who's unemployed, who gets caught stealing a loaf of bread to feed his children, that those are not the same kind of stealing. And so we have to, you know, reasonably talk about, well, what would be an appropriate punishment, because we don't end up making it impossible for the children to ever eat again, you know, because the father was trying to feed them and so forth. And that, if you study the history of this, it's an ongoing process. It's a work in progress that continues to shape and change in all sorts of ways. It's fluid. And so anytime you'd see somebody on television or listen to a radio program and say, oh, I'm holding the book of Sharia right here in my hand, so, well, okay, that's somebody's version of Sharia, but, you know, it's like you're already admitting you don't even know what you're talking about, because it's not just one thing. It varies a lot from time to time and place to place, and has to. But like our own legal system, there always are wrinkles that, you know, come into play in every case. And so, and much of it has to do, a great deal of Sharia has to do with, not with criminal justice issues at all, but how do you properly prepare a body for burial? How do you, you know, go through ritual cleansing processes before, you know, prayer or whatever it may be? A lot of it has to do with just piety questions, much like canon law would be in the Catholic tradition, say. So it's, again, breaking through that fear and that image that somehow they want to take over the world and they're going to impose this on us. And so what I try to help people see is, yes, you can find people out there, and some of them get a lot of, they get a big megaphone that somehow Islam is going to take over the world. And you get X number of people, and we saw it with ISIS, you know, X number of people, ideologues from different places, including the United States, who trek and make their way to Syria because they want to join the movement to take over, with the new caliphate to take over the world. There are about 1.7 billion Muslims in the world. Yes, there probably are, you know, several hundred thousand, maybe a million, maybe 2 million, I don't know. But even if there were 3 million Muslims who were ready to join the ranks of Al-Qaeda and ISIS and lay down their lives for the cause, this is less than 1% of the Muslim population. And so this is not, I mean, the vast majority of Muslims all over the world are doing exactly what the rest of us are doing. They're trying to put food on the table, figure out, did you get the flat tire fixed so we can go to grandma's birthday party tomorrow night? They're living normal lives, but we're not paying attention, you know, to the 230 million Muslims in Indonesia, because unless somebody blows something up, I like to just to give a sort of shocking little statistic. The largest Protestant denomination in the United States are the Southern Baptists. There are 15 times as many Muslims in the country of Indonesia as there are Southern Baptists in the world. And so what are they doing? Well, they're probably not sitting around the table trying to decide what they're going to blow up next. Most of them are trying to figure out the same things the rest of us are during the day. You go into the grocery store, who's going to stay home with a sick child, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so the more we can do to humanize the other, I think, the more we can break through those sort of stereotypical monolithic images of Islam. One of the things I point out in Truth Over Fear, I know a lot of Muslims in Oklahoma, and per capita across the United States, Muslims are far better educated than the average American per capita. A number of people, I think the Muslim population, it's hard to know for sure, but the best guess is probably 4% maybe of the U.S. population is Islamic, probably well over 10%, maybe as much as 13% of the medical professionals in the U.S. are Muslims. Several of the top oncologists, cardiologists, radiologists, urologists in Oklahoma are Muslims. Many of them have lived there for 30 years. They came from Pakistan or Syria or somewhere else. They're not trying to blow up anything. They're trying to save your life with heart surgery or cancer treatment or whatever it may be. And so the more you can do to put a human face on the other, then I think you begin to break through that. So to give you a quick little example, one of the things I often do, and I will confess, my spouse now of 49 years still runs for cover when I do this in public. But I've been in airports and other places many times when I hear someone pontificating and making derogatory comments about Muslims. In the same way, if you heard someone going off on a racist rant in public, you know, what would you do? You know, and I often will just inject myself and say, excuse me, but I couldn't help but hear you, like the rest of us. And I happen to know quite a bit about Islam, and what you're saying is just not true. And of course, you know, I'm ready to duck in case they try to deck me. And then, you know, we start talking a little bit, and it usually sort of shocks them that somebody would challenge them in public in a fairly gentle way. And then I'll say, well, do you happen to know any Muslims? Do you know any Muslims personally? And frequently the response will be something like, well, there's that guy Muhammad at CVS. He's a pharmacist, and I think he's a Muslim. I said, well, if his name's Muhammad, there's a pretty good chance he is a Muslim, yes. And, well, he's a really nice guy. I said, that's amazing. What are the odds? What are the odds out of 1.7 billion people you found the nice one? And, of course, you know, half the time it goes right over their head. The other half, it's like, oh, yeah, the only person I actually know is very nice. So I think you have to look for ways to sort of help people recognize their thinking in monolithic, stereotypical, racist terms and call it out for what it is.
And related to that, I'm watching the time. I would like to ask you a question that's sort of more close to home, and then I think Deborah will close this out maybe with a final question. So I was born and raised in Baptist, Southern Baptist churches. And I'm wondering if you were, and if you were, are you still affiliated with Southern Baptist churches? And then if yes, what has been the reception of your work? And I ask that question because, of course, the reception that I get is typically, I don't want to put a value on it, but I don't think that interfaith, you know, dialogue and interfaith relationship building, community building, that's kind of not where my people live. So I'm just curious what your experience has been there.
Yeah, again, this is a longer story, but the short version is I actually grew up Methodist. And then in high school, I dated a Southern Baptist minister's daughter for a couple of years. And if I wanted to see my girlfriend, I had to go to the Baptist church because she was there about five nights a week, forced marched there by her parents, along with her siblings. And my parents were just happy I was going to church, so that was fine. You know, they said, that's good. Well, I really got drawn into, I ended up marrying a Presbyterian, so I'm kind of a Methobapterian in some ways. And working at the National Council of Churches, I'm very committed to ecumenism. And, you know, I think the things that unite people are far more important than the things that have divided them historically in all traditions, really. But there's a lot about the Baptist tradition that I really cherish. Individual responsibility, soul freedom. I don't feel the need to have a bishop or a priest or someone else be my interlocutor to God, that I'm responsible for myself. I'm responsible for reading and studying the Bible myself and interpreting the Bible myself. And so there are a lot of things like that that I really resonate with. I was ordained Southern Baptist a long time ago now, 46 years ago, but basically left the Southern Baptist Church formally and yet remained Baptist. So in the 1980s, when the Southern Baptist as a whole kind of went fundamentalist big time, I began to refer to myself as a Baptist in the South rather than a Southern Baptist. There's a little difference between the two, as you know. And then you have the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, the Alliance of Baptists and others, and the American Baptist tradition as well. So there were there are 50 different Baptist denominations in the United States, including a number of Black Baptist denominations. So Baptists themselves are really all over the map. The image that people have, of course, is with the Southern Baptists, who tend to be very, very conservative en masse. Mm-hmm. That breaks down some, too, when you actually get into congregations and people and so forth, that not quite as monolithic as that. But the leadership has certainly been way to the right of center. But if you think about it, you know, Jesse Jackson's a Baptist, and Jimmy Carter and Al Gore, and, you know, but you also have Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell and Jesse Helms. And, you know, so I once was hosting Bill Moyers for a couple of days for a couple of major events at Wake Forest when I was there. And he grew up as a Baptist, Southern Baptist in Texas. And he paused at breakfast one morning. He said, Baptists are a lot like jalapeno peppers. He said, one or two make for a tasty dish. But he said, you get very many of them together in one place, it's bound to bring tears to your eyes. And so, the Baptist tradition is really all over theologically across the map. And that's part of what I like, but also part of what makes it pretty unruly, because there's no bishop to rein you in. There's nobody, as long as an individual congregation supports you, that church can do whatever it wants to do. This is a longer narrative, but, you hear occasionally about churches that get kicked out of the Southern Baptist, convention or this state Baptist convention. You literally cannot be kicked out of anything. You are part of this Oklahoma Baptist Convention or the Southern Baptist Convention by virtue of your contributions. You voluntarily join because you are an independent church and the authority is in that local church. What they do is they refuse to accept your donations. So you're excluded. You're not kicked out. You can't voluntarily join. That just shows the misperception that people have that somehow, but the Baptist tradition doesn't have this overarching sort of hierarchy that you find. There's value to both. In the Presbyterian Episcopal system, if you want to be ordained, you go through psychological tests, you go through a battery of exams and things to make sure you're not, don't have a few loose screws, before you get into the pulpit. And the Baptist tradition, there's no barriers. You don't even have to be well-educated. As long as you claim inspiration and a church agrees with that, then that allows for things all across the board. So I still appreciate very much the free church tradition. Mm-hmm. And it's not very far removed from the Disciples of Christ, for example, very similar kind of polity, or the United Church of Christ in the Northeast and Ohio, not the Church of Christ, but the United Church of Christ, the old congregational churches from New England, very similar, but they are among two of the most progressive and liberal denominations in the country, the First Christian Church, Disciples, and United Church of Christ. And so all of that is present in the Baptist tradition, too. It's just that most people don't know about it.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kimball, we could go on for hours and listen to you and talk with you. I'm so sad that this is coming to an end, but we really want to thank you for being with us today. Listeners, you can learn more about Dr. Kimball on his website, www.charles-kimball.com. You can also find his books, including the ones we discussed today, anywhere that you order books. Dr. Kimball, it was truly a great pleasure and honor.
Well, thank you. It was great to be with you.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast. We invite you to rate and review our show. And remember, you can find this interview and others on our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or anywhere you access podcasts. Don't forget to connect with us on Instagram and TikTok at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TCPodcast_. You can find more information about us and our show on our website. Again, that's theincarceratedchristian.com. Until next time, go forth in love and light.